I'm glad you're here. So if you're not in Western in American Heritage, everybody okay? All right. Did you see the professor who just walked in? Okay, he did. He's a business professor. I offered if he wanted a team teach, and he ran out. So anyway, okay, this is American Heritage, and we're going to be doing a lot in here. I do have your readers up here. In fact, why don't you guys, if you don't mind, just come on up haphazardly, chaotically, and grab these. Here's some here. Everybody should get one. Go.
In that case, I'm not going to get it for you.
Oh, okay. Now I'm alone.
When did you get that?
Yep.
Yep.
There we go. Oh, there we go. I couldn't grab it.
Okay, no. Everybody get one? Great.
Oh, yeah, Alex.
Okay, did everybody get one? Okay, so we're all set. Katie, would you like that box?
I mean, like...
All right,
I
this...
Hide a small animal.
You guys will have to forgive me. I still wave you to be blasphemous, but this is, may God forgive me, your Bible for this class. So make sure that you always bring this. This book is absolutely essential. We refer to it every day. The other book you have, the Tyndall She, I don't mind. If you want, you're welcome to buy it with a couple of other people and share it. I will be giving you what I call a kind of word chaser or term chaser that has things in it that I want you to know. There's some things in Tyndall She that are very, very good. There's some other things that are really bad. And I actually don't care which edition you get. All the editions will work just fine because of what we're doing. I think we're on the 10th edition now. Strangely enough, the very best of that book was the 1988 second edition. And if you can find a copy online, which you probably can of the second edition, that was... What it was that was when Tyndall had written it, and she only got his hands on the first part of it, and she's really made it a much more politically correct book than it ever was. But it's still about the best secondary book in American history that I've seen, and I use it a lot for reference, even when I'm doing my own academic work. So it's the only textbook I use at all, and it's still a textbook, which means it's automatically evil, but it's not as evil as other books are. I probably will not ask you to bring it to class, but I will be referring to a lot of the maps and a lot of the ideas that are in there. So I will be expecting you guys in the background to be reading it as, so if we're talking, for example, today, we'll get into the five folkways into America, and we're talking about colonial America, and we'll probably be done with colonial America by next week, but I'd like you to read through at least relatively, it can be fast, but read through the sections on colonial America. When we're on the Revolution, read about the Revolution. So I'm not going to be assigning it to you on a weekly basis or even a monthly basis. I may not bring it up that much, but just keep it in the background. For those of you who've had me before, which is about a quarter of you, if you've had me before, you know that I highly encourage you to work with one another. So when I send out, and it may be today, it may be next week, I'm not sure, I'll send out a term list of things I want you to know from Tyndall She. If you want to divide them, if Hannah wants to take 10 and Katie wants to take 10, and you guys want to kind of share that way, you can either share in small groups or a committee of the whole, whatever you want, I don't mind. So you just feel free, however you can learn it, and that's great. But do always come to class with this. If a day you forget, I'm not going to kick you out or anything. But I do want you as much as possible to bring this. I also want to make sure that you engage this book fully. So this is not a book by any means where, like Tyndall She, you can get through it and kind of just take what you need. We're going to be reading almost everything in here. Not quite. There'll be a few things we'll skip, and especially when we get into the 20th century, we'll be jumping around quite a bit. But for the most part, until we get to the Civil War, we'll be reading everything as is in the reader. And then in the 20th century, we'll jump around a lot because it gets chaotic because of the foreign policy situation and what's happening in America. We're not quite as isolated as we were, so there are a lot more influences going on. But do bring it. And I will, if you're having trouble in class, which, let's assume you're not, but just in case you are, and you come to my office and want to talk about it, probably the first thing I want to do is look at your reader. And I want to see how you've marked it up and how you've wrestled with it. So any of you who went to public school, you all know that like, the greatest bad thing you can do in public school, you can get away with almost anything, but you can't write in your books. Right? That's just the absolute no-no. That's the opposite in this class. We are the anti-public school class in here. So I want you, go listen to Pink Floyd's The Wall, get inspired. We hate public education. We're going to do everything possible to bring it down. I'm joking, but seriously, I want you to write this, write in the book and wrestle with it. It's really important to engage with the ideas. That said, you have to keep something in mind. I love American heritage, partly because it's what my field of specialty is and what I've spent a lot of my career doing. This book will never be quite as interesting as your Western Heritage book. That's hard. That's hard for me to admit, but it's true. There will be no Socrates in here. There's no St. John. There's no Augustine. You're not going to read people of that caliber with the exception of de Tocqueville. De Tocqueville is about the only person you'll read this semester who's at that level. But that doesn't mean these guys aren't important. I love George Washington. He's not Socrates, but he's Socrates with a gun. And that makes him really cool. He's just not Socrates. So you're not going to encounter those difficult thoughts. Most American public documents until the 20th century, we've changed completely. But up until the 20th century, public documents were exactly that. They were meant for everybody to be able to read. So there's nothing hidden when we read the Declaration. There's no reading between the lines. There's no Gnostic esoteric reading. If they say it, they mean it. And so that, now when we get into the 20th century, especially when we start with Woodrow Wilson, there's a whole interesting history of presidential lying, and no president is immune from it. I think there are presidents who aren't good at it because they're generally honest, but we'll see that as we get into the 20th century, it becomes the norm to deceive and not to write what you really believe. But that's not the case in the first two-thirds of American history. It was a virtue to speak your mind. Even if you're wrong, it's still a virtue to lay out your opinion. So there's nothing really tricky in anything we read. The only thing that will be tricky is maybe the context. Well, why would he talk about this or that or she on this? What's that mean? But generally, you can take things at face value when they're said up until the 20th century. It was just part of the public's awareness and understanding of things. Okay, so this book, critically important. You can see how important it is for me. Do you guys know what these tiles are? Mm-hmm. These are great. I don't lose things now. I used to go crazy finding keys and things. That's how important this book is. I always know where it is, and I just put this new tile on yesterday. I'm very excited. So, I don't think it beeps, does it, Melissa? I have to send my signal to it. Anyway, I'm not going to lose this. If you're Catholic, you just pray to St. Anthony or St. Jude. But if you're not Catholic, you use tile. So I happen to be Catholic and use tile. So that means I'm really trying to make sure. But anyway, there it is. So we'll come back to that over and over again. Okay, so just a couple of things about this class and what we're going to be doing. It's going to be very similar to what you had in Western Heritage. And I realize for some of you, that was last semester, and for a lot of you, that was a while ago. So this class is not like Western Heritage in the sense that I'm expecting a lot more of you. Even if you're not a sophomore yet, even if you're a freshman, I'm going to be gearing this class really towards a second semester sophomore. So those of you, I know all of you who are in here I've had before, you're all going to be totally fine. But I just want you to know this won't be quite as introductory as that class was. It's also not going to be, I'm teaching this semester as well, tomorrow I've got American Civil War. It won't be at that level either. I'm going to try and gear it in between. I do, however, talk very fast, and especially in American history where, sometimes in Western history I'm thinking, please don't ask me a question because I don't know anything beyond what I'm telling you. That's not true in this, for better or worse. I actually know this stuff, unlike, say, ancient Greece. You may have thought I knew it, and I hope I fooled you, but when it comes to American history, I actually know this stuff fairly well, not perfectly, of course, but I tend to talk very fast. I will record every class if I remember to bring my recorder, and I put all my lectures online. So if you miss a class, or if I said something you're not sure about, or you may catch me contradicting myself, it's all right there. So you can always download these. I'll put them at my personal website. I haven't sent you the URL to that. It's just stormfields.wordpress.com. We'll get you all that later. But I'll be doing things on there as well. But anytime you need, I am not a stickler, for better or worse. I'm not a stickler about you attending class. So you know, if you need, for whatever reason, not to attend class because, you know, God forbid there's some family emergency, or at 12 o'clock, you probably wouldn't. You probably all have lunch. But you know, if at 1 o'clock you've got a Greek test with Garn Yost, I understand if you need to skip this class. That's prudent. That's fine. You don't need to clear it with me. I'll trust your judgment. But I will start getting worried. Now, if, for example, and I don't know if you know Hannah, she's like a total mess. She's had all kinds of disciplinary problems. But you know, if I see that Hannah, for example, back there is missed like 2 weeks in a row, I'll probably become dad and call her and wonder what's going on. But other than that, so I do notice, right? It's a small enough class. Logan, I'll make fun of his hair all semester, and I'll ask him to perform circus tricks for us if he misbehaves. But you know, I do start getting into, you know, 49-year-old dad mode at some point. But I trust your judgment, so just try not to miss too much, all right? Try to be here as much as you can. And it's good for continuity, I think. Okay, so what are we going to do? This class, like Western Heritage, is broken into three parts. So there will be two midterms and one final. So I've got those dates for you already on the syllabus. Hopefully you all got that. I sent that email out, or at least it was a group email. You should have all gotten it. I'm still playing with the new system on that. If you didn't get that email, let me know. We'll make sure that you're on that list. But you have three exams, not all equal. The first two are equal to one another. The final, your final is a big deal. It's a third of your exam, third of your class, grade in the class. So it really does shape things. It means that even if you go into class, into the final with an A, you know, if you don't do well in the final, it can knock you down to a B. But if you do really well and you're at a B, it can bring you up to an A as well. But everything's geared towards the final. And if you had a chance to look at your syllabus, you know, I've already got your final questions there. So they're goofy, but you'll see that they, hopefully they'll make sense by the time you get to that. But everything that I'm going to be doing in this class is geared towards you answering those three final questions. And the final will be bigger than that, but those are the three questions that you have. So feel free to start thinking about that now. Again, get into groups, exchange ideas, and so forth. But the class will be divided not just by the three exams, but by three small papers. They're only, you know, 700 to 900 words. I've already got the topics on there and the due dates for those. So you can already start thinking there's nothing complicated. The questions should be pretty straightforward. You don't have to answer the question exactly on a paper. It's just a guide. So, for example, on your final paper, where I have you look at two documents, if you want to focus on one at the exclusion of the other, that's fine. It's not like an exam question. Those questions for your papers are starting questions, not ending questions. So you can go any direction you want. They're just not research papers, things you just take from the documents that we have. So you don't need to do any research on any of those. So three exams, three papers. There'll be some other minor grades, participation a little bit, maybe quizzes, depending on how things. If I feel like you're not doing the reading, I might give you a quiz. But chances are good we won't have any quizzes in here. We'll just see how things go like that. But the class then, the divide is this. And this I do want you to write down, because we're going to be thinking about it this way the whole semester. So for the first third of the course, we're looking at small r Republican America. What does it mean to found a republic? So whether it's colonial or the revolution, we're going to be looking at the ideas of a republic, small r, right? Not Republican Party yet, but small r republic. What is a republic? That will go basically what we start today at the end of class, towards the end of class. We'll get to the Mayflower Compact. We'll start with that. We'll roughly get through Lewis and Clark's expedition. I'm not going to talk a lot about it in here, but we'll mention it. That's kind of the end of Republican America. And the Lewis and Clark expedition is the high point of Jeffersonian Republican America. After that, after your first exam, again, give me some leeway here, because it just depends where we're at, how much you're talking, and so forth, what I get interested in as we're going. In the second part of the semester, so basically around spring break time, we're going to be looking at what we call democratic America. So why is America democratizing? That's basically Jefferson's administration up until the Civil War, through the Civil War. So we'll probably get to the Civil War right before your second exam. And then when we come back in April, after spring break and Easter, our final days will be looking at what we call progressive America. And that gets really complicated because progressive America is also outward America. In the first two periods, we're basically just trying to figure out who we are. In that third period, we're now trying to assert ourselves on the rest of the world. And that makes it much, much, much more complicated. And frankly, and I didn't get into this in the previous class, but one reason I want to do this as well, again, you have to forgive the kind of fatherly side of me on this, but you guys are all, you're the age of my oldest son now. He's applying for college right now as, well, actually, he better be in class right now, but when he's not in class, he's applying for college. You're younger than the freshman here. But you guys are all going to have to deal with a very, very complicated world, a world that's much more complicated than when I was your age. It's just, that's not nostalgia. It's not me looking back at a golden era. When I was, I graduated college in the spring of 1990, and we hadn't invaded Iraq yet. Yeah, that was still a year away. We'd invaded Panama, which was weird, but we had not invaded Iraq. I grew up, my high school years were very peaceful. The 80s were the most peaceful decade outside of the 20s of the entire 20th century. We knew who the bad guys were. They were commies. It was that simple. Everybody else was okay. Commies were bad. And you guys don't have that. I feel sorry for you in many ways. You have a security state that's very different. Nobody spied on me when I was a kid. There was no TSA pat down when I got on an airplane. It was like Home Alone. You could run through the airport. Nobody cared. If you're running through the airport, they don't think you're a terrorist. You're late for your plane. It's just a very different world, and you guys are going to be entering into a world that's just not as simple. Racism is much greater today than it was when I graduated high school. I never would have given it a second thought. When I graduated high school, I thought racism was a thing of the past. I think most people did. That's not the case today. So I feel weird for you guys, and I'm sorry that you're inheriting a world that my generation didn't do so well with. It's actually more my parents' generation, but it's easy to blame someone else. But anyway, we're going to talk about that, and I want you to realize that we are moving from a kind of simple understanding to an extremely complex and convoluted understanding, to the point where, the fact in most schools, we would just say, well, that's okay. You think one way, I think another way. Nobody would have said that in early America. So we're going to look at what changes in the 20th century. And I do want to warn you, we're also going to watch a film clip. It's one of the most depressing things you'll ever see in your life. But I want you to watch it. It's R, but it's not. There's no language, nothing. We're going to watch 20 minutes of a scene in the gulag when we get to the end of class. And it's horrifying. And if you walk out of here happy, something's wrong with you. I want you to be depressed. And I know that sounds terrible, but it's just, you've got to see what was happening. You've got to know what's happening. And me growing up, I grew up with quarter horses and a farm in Kansas. I didn't see the gulag. My childhood was pretty innocent, and yet all this was going on. So I want you to see what the world has happened, what has changed, and what's gone on. Up until that point, it's a lot of fun. So the first two parts of the semester are hilarious. I mean, they're great. We get to talk about heroes like George Washington. He's nobody better in the world. This guy is, he's basically a demigod. It's a lot different than Hitler or Stalin, right? So, and that's why it changes. Woodrow Wilson is scum. Abraham Lincoln's pretty cool. And that's a big change. And we're going to see that. Reagan's cool. He's really cool. But Nixon? Clinton? These aren't good people. So anyway, we're going to see a lot of changes here in what's going on. Okay, so any questions on that? Because Republican, Democratic, and then Progressive America. Okay? All right, so let's start. Unless there are any questions on the syllabus or anything else, and I hope you guys know you can, anytime you have a question, just stop or a comment or a thought. Alex.
So on the syllabus you sent us, there wasn't a date for this.
Did I not put one on?
There's only one midterm date.
Oh, geez, I'm sorry. It's the week after your paper's due, I think.
Okay.
The second paper.
Friday the 31st?
Yes, that should be right. That's not Good Friday, is it?
No.
Okay, yeah, that should be right. It should be, I'll double check that. Alex, email me, if you don't mind, and thank you for that. I'm sorry about that, this stupid typo. Okay.
Yeah, no, Good Friday is not until April.
Okay, good, good. All right, excellent. Anything else? Thanks, Alex. And thanks, what's your name? Who answered?
Lindsay,
thank you. Okay. All right, good. Well, let's start with the colonial period then and what happens here. And some myths I want to break and some others that I want to reinforce. We, as we teach this course, and there's not a lot of way of getting around this easily, but I want you to understand that this whole course that we're teaching here, this marriage course, is based on a very particular narrative that is driven by a New England way of thinking. So if we were, you know, we're basically going to be going, let me say this a couple times during class, this class, as we look at ideas, we're going to go from Plymouth Rock all the way to Rodeo Drive. So we are moving across America, and that is a very kind of Turnerian, New England, progressive vision of America. If we were, for example, to stand in San Antonio in 1717, or if we were to stand in Santa Fe, New Mexico in 1690, the world would look very, very different. Same thing is true if we were standing in Quebec in 1697. I mean, how many of you have ever read Willa Cather's novel, Shadows on the Rocks? Incredible story about a 12-year-old girl living in Quebec that winter. Incredible story. But that's my point is, we are very much standing at Boston, walking to California. That's, for better or worse, that's our narrative. It's, I don't think, quite an accurate narrative. It is one of many. It's the one we'll mostly engage in here. But I would ask also that we can't think of America without thinking of multiple groups coming to America. So that the single most cosmopolitan city in the entire world is Houston, Texas today. More ethnicities are represented in that one city than even Singapore. Singapore would be number two. But that's astounding to think about that. In Houston, Texas, of all places, the most cosmopolitan part of the world. So we're going to be looking, though, specifically, especially today, at the English Celtic settlement of what we call the New English colonies. Not New England. I mean, we will look at New England, but the New English colonies. So everything from basically New Hampshire all the way down to Georgia, originally, the first 13 colonies of the English world. That's what we're going to be looking at. And I want you to know, and you're going to need to know this for every exam, and we're going to keep talking about this because I'm very interested in peoples in particular. But when we look at America all the way up until 1846, so when we're talking about America from the very first arrival at Jamestown and Plymouth Rock up until 1846, there are only five major peoples that settle in English North America. Only five total. And there are other groups. I don't want to suggest this is it, but for groups that determine who and what we are. So there's the New Netherlands, of course. Yeah, this is where the Vanderbilts and the Roosevelts, they're all these old Dutch families that settle on the Hudson in New York. There's a New Sweden in what's now Delaware. So don't get me wrong. There are other groups, but when we're talking about 95% of the population, the population that really shapes America, shapes our discourse, shapes our ideas, we're talking about only five groups total. And four of those groups you can see here on this map. I'll turn the light off, give you a better image, of England. So we have four groups that are free, and they're relatively free. We have one group, the Africans, that are unfree. So those are the five groups, four from England, and then the Africans. Four free, relatively speaking, one unfree. Those five peoples will make up all of America until 1846. So a couple of things as we look at this map that I want you to think about, and I'm going to give you the groups as they matter in terms of settlement in chronological order. So the most important group, and I know you all know Jamestown, right? First settlement, doesn't matter. Jamestown's unimportant for us. Not that it's not a neat story, but Jamestown does not have any European women until 1619, which means that for almost two decades, it's only a colony of men. And
hopefully you don't need to get into biology 101. You all understand there is no community anywhere over the long run without men and women. It takes both. So the idea that Jamestown's important isn't, because what matters is where you make community. You cannot have community. It's one thing if you're a Delft for 4 years. That's fine. But if you're in Jamestown with no women for 20 years, that's not a community, right? I hope that all makes sense for everybody. So we're talking about communities. And the first people who come over as a community are the people who will settle New England. They are New England Puritans. So the first group, writ large, group number one, the Puritans. And I'll come back and talk about them in a little bit. But I want you to notice there's some peculiar things. If you just look at the map for a moment, all of the Puritans that settle in what's now New England, they all come from one specific spot of England. This is called East Anglia. They are all from this spot. And we don't know exactly why, but it's just kind of an interesting tidbit. These people generally, even though they've been intermixed with the Anglo-Saxons, they generally are the Anglo-Saxons that also have the Danish blood from the Dane law. So it's just one of those weird facts. Why did the Puritans, what is it about the Danish culture that infiltrates England 700 years earlier that creates something that these will be the Puritans? It's really weird, and I don't know exactly why. We just know it's a fact. So most of these people are the Scandinavians who had invaded as Vikings and then become a part of the Anglo-Saxon culture. They all leave, not all, but this group that leaves comes from East Anglia. They leave from here, they settle in New England. Group number one. Very important because they're Calvinists. They're probably not, if any of you are Calvinists, now I assume we're at Hillsdale, probably a third of you are at least, they're probably not the kind of Calvinists you would recognize. And I'll talk about that somewhat today, more probably on Friday. New England Calvinism is a very peculiar form of Calvinism. It is not, I'm not sure Calvin would recognize it, frankly, but we'll get into that and what that means. It's very typical for a lot of religions, not just Calvinism, but we'll see that. So when they come, keep this in mind, they are leaving in the 1620s and 1630s, about 40,000 of them leave England and settle New England. When they come, they do so because they are trying their best to get away from the Anglicans. They hate the Anglicans, despise them. Even the Catholics aren't as bad as the Anglicans. They are in theory, but there aren't Catholics on the continent, in England, so you don't have to worry about them. The Anglicans are the ones you have to worry about. These people are called roundheads because they put a bowl on, the men do put a bowl on their head and shave like monks. They have no vanity. They hate the Anglicans. The Anglicans look like Logan with the long hair and kind of making hair demonstrable, as opposed to the roundheads who just cut it off because they're not vain. I'm not saying you're vain, Logan. That's just how they, maybe. So that's just how they think about it, okay? Group number two, the people they hate, and who hate them, the Anglicans. So the Anglicans almost all come from this area of England, western, southern England, southwest England. Oh, one thing I didn't tell you, almost all of the Puritans went to Cambridge. The Anglicans almost all went to Oxford. Another just kind of weird tidbit. So they all come. There are about 40,000 of them. Lo and behold, just like the New Englanders. They all settle in Virginia, in the Carolinas, and somewhat in Georgia. Now, there's a major, major difference between these two groups. Not just their religion, but also their social structure. And you have to keep this in mind. So, in New England culture, and you guys, I hope you all know I'm speaking relatively here, but it doesn't matter if your name is Zane or Katie. If you are elect, you're elect. Meaning that in New England culture, women have very high standing compared to any other Protestant world. If you are Protestant, now in Catholic culture, you'd be a nun, but of course you'd be separated. You'd have a high standing, you'd just be with only other women. But in Protestant culture, among the Protestants,
Calvinists are by far the most gender neutral, simply because if you're elect, you're elect. Now, Katie's still not at Zane's level because she's a female, according to the Calvinists. I say this because when we look at the Anglicans, even if you are married to the wealthiest Anglican man, you are still a beast of burden. You're barely human as a woman. So the Virginians who come over have very low regard for women. Women are ornaments at best and probably workhorses most of the time. So it's a very different view. The New Englanders tend to be equal among each other. The Anglicans tend to be very hierarchical. And if I tell you a few names, they're all going to be familiar to you. All these people who come from England, these Anglicans and settle in Virginia, last names like Mason, Fairfax, Madison, Washington, Jefferson, Custis, Lee, these are all the prominent families. And when they come as a hierarchy. So even if you have 100 Anglicans in one group, remember there were about 40,000, but even if in one group you had 100 Anglicans, probably only one of them mattered, whoever the patriarch was. Everybody else was under the patriarch. Whereas if you've got 100 New Englanders, they're all pretty equal to one another. So it's a totally different situation socially. Who do the Anglicans absolutely hate? Why are they leaving England? They hate the Calvinists. So I stress this now, and I feel kind of bad. I've used hate like 10 times in this lecture already. Not one of my favorite words, but important. Already, with the settlement of New England and the settlement of Virginia, we're already ready for the American Civil War. It's all there. I'm not exaggerating. All the seeds of it are there. What's amazing is that it took so long for the Civil War to happen. That's what's amazing. And the fact that they were able to get along for a few years to overthrow England, that's astounding. Not that there's a Civil War, but that they prevented it for so long. So, those of you who walked around downtown Hillsdale and imagine it in its heyday when it was really beautiful, I just think about the layout. What's it laid out like? Anybody know? The whole layout of downtown, the triangular form, where the courthouse is and the churches and the businesses. Notice the churches are on one side, courthouse in the middle, businesses on the other side. That's mixed a bit now, but think about how that is. And at the bottom is the courthouse of the triangle. Pretty interesting. Anybody know what that is? Who settled Hillsdale? What do you think? Think Southerners settled it? Founded Hillsdale College? This is a total Yankee town. This is all New England. Hillsdale is laid out like a New England township. And no surprise that it's an abolitionist college. And so I'm not exaggerating here. If you look at the map, you can trace exactly New Englanders moving west. Exactly, almost vote by vote, county by county, how they voted for Abraham Lincoln in 1860. These are the people, these New Englanders who vote for Lincoln. Who hates them? The Lees. It's already there, the whole divide, and we'll look at that later. Okay, third group. One I would guess most of you know the least about, though the image should be the most familiar to you. How many of you have ever had Captain Crunch? Who makes Captain Crunch? It's Quaker, right? All of you have grown up with the image of William Penn on your cereal boxes, if your mom and dad allowed you to have sugared cereal. So, Quaker, you've got it, right? Quaker Oats. So the third group are the Quakers, and they were also pretty egalitarian, far more so than the Anglicans. I mean, everybody's more egalitarian than the Anglicans, but they're far more so. They settle, again, about probably 30,000 of them. They leave what are called the English Midlands, where Yorkshire is, northern England, that middle area. They leave and they settle almost exclusively in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. So they're the third group. Now, all of those groups are obviously defined by their religions. So the Puritans, the Anglicans, and the Quakers. That makes the fourth group very hard to define. The fourth group who settle are not religious. They're almost all Presbyterian, meaning a Scottish form of Calvinism, but they could care less. What they care about is being Scottish.
and they especially care about whatever clan they belong to.
These are almost all lowland Scots. So lowland, right? Lowland Scots, who settle in the six Protestant counties of Ireland for a bit, don't like it, and then come to America. So we just call these people the Scotch-Irish.
They're the hardest to define. And the reason is because, unlike the other three groups, where we can show exactly where they came from and where they settled, the Scotch-Irish never settle in one area. They settle everywhere. So the Scotch-Irish always settle by clan. You know, if you're Clan MacDonald, you settle with the other MacDonalds. If you're Clan McConnell, you settle with the other McConnells. MacAndrew, you always do that. And even within those clans, you have sub-clans. So they are Presbyterian, but they're only Presbyterian because that's what good Scots are. The first and most important thing is to be Scottish. Okay. Yeah.
Isn't it true that the Scots-Irish, like when they settled in Ireland, they only bred within the Scottish and did not mix?
They did not mix a lot. There was some mixing because they're all Celtic Protestants, right? But there isn't a, it's a great question, Rachel. It's not a huge, right, so by any means. And I don't want to exaggerate this too much, but if you ever want a great understanding of Scottish male culture, which is so true, watch the Pixar movie Brave. Those guys, they are Scots in every way. So when I saw that movie with my daughters, I was just laughing uproariously. It's like, yeah, these are the people I read about in the mountains of Virginia. This is great. So anyway, that's what's important to them. Now, I want you to keep that in mind, that the Scotch-Irish are very numerous, but they don't settle in any concentrated area. And they, too, dislike one another. But the only thing that a Scot dislikes more than a Scot is a non-Scot. So if it's the MacDonalds and the MacAndrews, they're going to fight like mad. But the moment a Washington comes in, they don't like Washington, and they'll band together. Right, it's a very violent culture, but we'll get into that. And it's a very male culture as well. But again, we'll get into all that later. But those are the four migrations. So what do we know? What can we say about the free peoples who come to America? This is pretty important. They are all Anglo-Saxon Celtic, and they are all Protestant. So that really matters, because what that means, and I hope this isn't offensive to anyone, it's just kind of a fact of American history, what that means is that all Roman Catholics and Jews are more or less alien to the original American culture. And that does matter. It doesn't matter as much today, and I was born in 67, but even going back and looking at the election of 1960, when John F. Kennedy, as a Catholic, not really, had like 50 lovers on the side, so wasn't exactly a good Catholic, but even when he was elected, it was still a kind of, we can't have a Catholic in the White House, it's very dangerous. And that's just, you don't have to be bigoted to understand that Catholics are just kind of alien in a lot of ways. So this is why, and I stress this, for our whole first third, except with one exception, we'll talk about Charles Carroll, but for the whole first third of our semester, we are talking about free, white, Anglo-Saxon Protestant peoples. They are the Americans. Now, the other group, of course, who are not free through no fault of their own, rarely do people not choose their unfreedom. The other people, of course, are the Africans, who are brought over against their will. And you can see here just a couple of things. We'll get into this in great detail much later in the class. But as you can see, they are almost exclusively from West Africa, with only a few coming from East Africa and Madagascar, only a few. And almost all of them go to South America. Only 5% of Africans come to North America during the colonial period. And there are a lot of reasons for that. A lot of it has to do with who's shipping, who's capturing, and who's shipping. A lot of it has to do with environment, too. Notice that, and this is always true, I want you guys to keep this in mind. We'll talk more about it on Friday. But notice where the English succeed. English, of course, would love to take over the whole world. They tried to take over India and China. Do India and China today look English? Not at all. Not in the least. But let's go to upstate New York. Anyone expect Albany to look like an old Iroquois village? But we don't go to New Delhi and think it's going to look like London, right? So something has changed. And what we find is that the English are incredibly successful
wherever they go to a soil and a climate that is just like their own. They can remake the whole thing. North America is England on steroids. We are, except where? Where is black settlement? Englishmen get to the swamps of Virginia. They don't know what to do. This is humid. This is crazy. They import people from an equivalent climate. It's a weird part of history. But this is why you're never going to find slavery doing well in New England. It doesn't work. Environment's not right. But it's perfect in Virginia. It's a weird thing in history. But we'll talk about that a lot as well. And I please don't think I'm being environmentally determinist. I'm not. I believe free will is trumps everything. But there's no doubt that environment shapes the way we think about things, and it shapes our responses as well. So this is why we skip over the Great Plains, too. Now you can imagine, you get out to the Great Plains, no trees, 15 inches of rainfall at best in Nebraska. This makes no sense. Of course you're going to go on to the Willamette Valley. Oregon makes sense. Kansas makes no sense to an Englishman at all. And in fact, it will wait. It's my ancestors, the Russian Germans, who grew up on the southern steppes, who figure out what to do in Kansas because the environment's identical. So there are, again, I don't want to be determinist, but it does shape things. Okay, so any questions about those five groups? If not, we're going to go straight into the Puritans. And just for a little bit, we'll finish up, go full class today, but about 8 more minutes. Okay, so you're all fine. All right, well, let's look then at the Puritans and try and think about what it is that the Puritans are doing and what their purpose is. So I've given you just a couple of terms you'll see magically appear here with the beautiful technology of chalk on the board. What's happening with this first major migration? Again, forget Jamestown for a moment. We're going to think about major migrations. So the English Calvinists, and they are distinctive from other forms of Calvinists, the English Calvinists are a particular group within England, of course, that are deeply worried that the Anglicans are going to gain ascendancy over them and run them out, which is why they come to America. It's a safe haven. But there are two groups who come, one that makes up about 1% of all the Puritans, and the other that makes up about 99% of all the Puritans. And yet we remember the one. We remember the Pilgrims. They're tiny. We were talking about one of the smallest migratory communities ever in history, but they matter because they do something that creates a foundation for all others. So here's the big difference between the two. And they don't like each other, but the Puritans will have absorbed the Pilgrims roughly by the end of the first generation. So by 1635, there are really no separate Pilgrims anymore. They're all Puritans. A Pilgrim, and of course it's just scriptural, Pilgrim is a term for any Christian, right? We're sojourners in this world. We're strangers in this world. So a pilgrim is just a Christian, but specifically as they thought of themselves, they called themselves separating Puritans. And what they meant by that was that they believed, and I mean this quite literally, this is not an exaggeration, they believed that the Church of England had remained so Catholic in its sacraments, in its use of saints, in the use of incense, even if it says, yeah, the 39 articles say there can only be 2 sacraments, Anglicans practice 7, you know, those kinds of things that Pilgrims are furious about. And they literally believe, no exaggeration, that at any moment, God's hand will reach down and destroy England as an island. He'll just wipe it off the face of the earth. It's not like he's going to send a plague and let it be slow. I mean, his fist is coming down and it's gone. And so their goal to separate is literally that. We're getting out of here. These are like the guys who are hiding out in the bunkers waiting for the apocalypse. And so they get out of England as quickly as they can, and they renounce all ties to the mother country because, man, they're not a part of that. Now, they don't renounce political ties, but they do renounce religious ties. So they are forming a separate congregation. The majority of Puritans believe that this is actually the single greatest sin a Christian can commit. It's the lack of charity. So the other Pilgrims, the Puritans, the larger Pilgrims, Puritans like John Winthrop, they believe that they are coming over to America not to separate, but to leaven. So they leave England and settle in Boston because they're going to create a city upon a hill. And they're still a part of the church. It's all one Christian church. Even the Catholics, as fallen as they are still part of it. Charity demands that you stay with your brethren, but you show them the way. And that's what they're trying to do. Now, that may seem like we're parsing things, because clearly they leave England. But they don't have the theology that God's going to wipe them out at any moment, like the pilgrims do. So most of the Puritans are non-separating, and their highest goal is love. Love, charity demands that you stay with your brethren, even when they're fallen. So yeah, the guy's drunk, he's fallen down, he's committing all kinds of lewd crimes. I've still got to help him. I can't just leave him there. He's my brother. So that's their idea. Okay, does that make sense? So that's the difference between a pilgrim and a Puritan, though they're all Puritans, but why there's a subset. Okay, so why do they matter? The pilgrims matter for one thing, and it's a glorious thing. So please turn, open your book. We're going to turn to this one, and I would ask, by the way, for Friday for you to read pages in your reader, 13 up through, I think, 20. Read pages 13 through 31 of your reader for Friday. So what do they do that's amazing? And I've taught this now. I've been thinking about this since college. I've taught this now. This is my 18th year of teaching this. I never, ever get bored with this. I'm going to make an argument. You don't have to agree with me. In fact, almost every political scientist on the campus would disagree with me, though almost every historian would agree with me. It's just one of those weird divides between politics and history. But I would argue that this document on page 13, what we call the Mayflower Compact, is the founding document of America, even more than the Declaration of Independence. I don't think there could have been a declaration without the Mayflower Compact. Now, let me give you, we've only got 4 minutes left, so let me explain why and what I mean by that. First thing is I have on the board, and this is going back to almost 40 minutes ago, so much of our history is a New England way of thinking. For better or worse, we teach history like the New Englanders would. In 1793, a group of New England historians trying to convince America that they are the true America, not the Southerners. There's a huge movement to do this. So 1793, after the American Revolution, they go back and rename what was originally called the Plymouth Combination, the Mayflower Compact. And the reason they name it the Mayflower Compact, a full almost two centuries after it was written, the reason they name it is because compact is a Lockean term. And they're trying to show that they were good Lockeans. Anybody know what combination means in English? Especially in the English of the 1600s? It means covenant. Combination is the exact same word as covenant. Same thing that Abraham and Moses made with God. So when these guys are on at Plymouth Rock on the Mayflower and they make this document, it is a covenant. It is not a compact. And so even though that name sticks, it matters. It's not a political document as much as it is a religious document. So you all have to know that. It's the Plymouth Combination. But here's what's astounding about it. That's not that astounding, actually, when you put it into context. These guys are Christian, hardcore. They're starting over. Of course they would. But here's what matters. They are landing almost 1,000 miles off course. They're supposed to be in Virginia. That's where their charter is. They land in New England. Not 1,000, sorry, about 300 miles off course. They're off course. They land in this very barren, cold place. But when they land, there are no Indians there. Because English fishermen had come through about a generation earlier, and disease from the English fishermen had wiped out all the Indians. So they don't know that. They just know they arrive at this place and it's free of people. It's theirs. They don't have to fight anybody, nothing. It's theirs. And not only that, the Indians who had once lived there had been farmers. So the land's been cleared, the fields are ready to be sown. It's amazing. This is paradise. God has given them everything you can possibly imagine. But they have no law. None. It's anarchy. And yet, how many of us read about stories? When we celebrate Thanksgiving, how many of us in the middle of our Thanksgiving feast pull out our pistols and duel with one another? It's not the image, right? Indians and pilgrims all living in harmony, sharing food, which is pretty accurate, actually. Well, what do? These guys in the middle of nowhere, men and women, remember women are almost equal, not quite, but almost equal in Calvinist society. What do they say? We're in the middle of nowhere. We have no law. We don't know what we're doing. We've never seen this environment before. We're here. It's almost winter. Well, we have two things. We have scripture, and we have the English common law. And with those two things alone, we can create a society. That is astounding. In the history of the world, that it may not be as dramatic as the Battle of Thermopylae, it's just as important. People basically saying, we're people. Of course we govern ourselves. This is what we do. And that, it's just, you can't exaggerate the importance of that, that they could do that. And I will stress this. There are things we as Americans do horribly. One thing we do better than anybody else in the world, we create communities. We create communities for everything. To help the homeless, to paint the town, to join a sorority, to form a college, to start a business, to start a family. We're incredible. Nobody forms communities like we do. It is our great gift to the world. It is what we do best. And that's exactly what we see here. Bunch of people, middle of nowhere, and they just say, of course we can do it. We're men. We're human. We've got God. We've got English law. That's all you need. That's cool. Okay, thanks everybody. I will see you on Friday. Have a great Wednesday and Thursday, and we'll pick this back up. Make sure you read those New England documents. All right?